You're listening to episode 44 of The Marketer's Mindset with Brian Burkhard. Welcome back to The Marketer's Mindset, the podcast where we talk about how to create and sustain a powerful mindset to help you build a successful online business and lead a happy and abundant life. Okay, everyone, I'm really excited to talk with today's guest. This gentleman from Australia has a unique background that has taken his life on a massive journey to self-discovery. In his early 20s, with a love for music, he enrolled as a music school student at Victorian College of the Arts, where he met others that were free thinkers and caused him to think about his beliefs and how he was brought up. As time went on, and through a series of life events, he began feeling dissatisfied and was waiting for life to happen, that there was more to life than was being presented to him. During this time of uncertainty with his life, he read a book that would change the course of his life. Through his quest to find himself and figure out life, he was told about a Western monk located in Melbourne, Australia. A visit to this monk sent his life on a new trajectory, where he studied Buddhism and philosophy and ended up becoming an ordained Buddhist monk. He would spend over 15 years living and studying with Tibetan lamas both in Australia and in India, and also had the honor of meeting and spending time with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. While trying to hold a full-time job as a web developer during the day and practicing living as a monk outside of work, he easily felt the tug of joy and passion towards meditating and practicing as a monk and away from the corporate world. With his love of Buddhism, philosophy, and education, and a desire to create a career where he could pursue these passions and support himself financially, he decided to leave the monastery and pursue a PhD in education. Through this incredible journey of self-discovery, this former Buddhist monk and PhD student has gone on to become a writer, speaker, and a life and wellness coach who draws on his 22-plus years of philosophical education and contemplative practice to help business owners, entrepreneurs, and educators discover their own potential. He is the founder of Think Like a Meditator, How to Unlock Your Hidden Potential to an Extraordinary Life. And he has gone on to write and direct his first feature film called A Thousand Moments Later, due to be released by the end of this year. Please welcome Clark Scott to the show. Clark.
G'day, Brian. How are you going?
Oh, I'm doing awesome. How are you?
Very well. And feeling quite humbled after that introduction. It sounds like I've had quite an extraordinary life from my point of view. It's odd, I got to say. It's odd to hear your life narrated back to you. I think I'd like to be that guy.
You are that guy, though.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, I know. It's true. Life,
no, and I,
as
I
we all know, life has its ups and its downs. And in a narrated bio, we often only get the good bits.
Yes, exactly. And I think the good bits are fine and it's good to inspire people, but I think the real inspiration comes from talking about the challenges and the obstacles that people overcome and that come out on top on the other side, and you see the resilience. And I think that's really where the inspiration really comes from.
Yeah. In fact, that just reminded me, what you just said then reminded me of, have you seen the Amy Winehouse documentary?
You know, I haven't. My fiance has, and she said it's awesome. And I know you mentioned it, so I need to check that out.
Yeah, there's a quote in at the end. So she was an amazing singer, and it's a tragic story. And the men in her life mostly were just horrible, except for a few. And one was Tony Bennett, the jazz singer. And he said towards the end of the movie, he said, it was after she passed, he said that it's such a tragedy because life will teach you to live as long as you can live long enough. And when I heard that, it really struck me as being something that's incredibly true. And I think Freud said something similar, that life begins at 40. Everything before that is mere research. And in my own life, I can see that that's just true. It's we are trying to work out what the hell is going on for a long time. And in fact, I'd say that life, and I hope this doesn't sound like a silly platitude, but life is in some ways this journey of discovery. So, and I think if you can come at life with that kind of motivation, then both the ups and the downs are meaningful, but the downs are even more prophetic than the ups. The ups are still meaningful, but they have less wisdom to give us, where the downs are like, okay, I know what I'm doing, or I think I know what I'm doing wrong and how to change that.
No, I agree with you totally on that, Clark. And it was funny because earlier today when I was thinking about our interview and our discussion that we were about to have, and I don't know, for some reason I thought about life, and I think it was what really kicked in. That's what it was. It was today is 9/11. So it's a lot of people remembering what happened that tragic day here in the States.
And I still remember where I was. I can remember waking up. Yeah. I can remember the faces of the people in the monastery. I was in the monastery at the time. And I remember being with my lama when we first heard.
Yeah, it was – and that's one of those things when those events happen, it's you know, makes a mark. It sticks with you and you remember where you're at, what you were feeling and stuff. And I thought about the people that lost their lives and the families and stuff. And for some reason, Clark, I was just thinking about how life – you know, they always talk about the yin and the yang. And I want to talk to you more about that with your Buddhist background and how that plays into it and what the teachings were, you know, around things like that. But I started thinking about time. You know, you're still going to be hurt in the people that you lost, but time has a way of kind of easing that pain a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And you start to remember some of the good stuff. And I just thought about life is just basically these events that happen, and we're the ones that label it good or bad, you know?
Yep.
We're the ones that put it on there. And there's always going to be, you're not going to know the good in life if there's not the bad, you know, what we so-called bad. So you got to have these opposites in life to truly, you know, go through and enjoy life. It's kind of weird to say, but you need those to really appreciate the good stuff and the happy times that come. So it was just weird. And I just thought a lot about it because I knew our discussion here, we're going to dive into a lot of philosophy and Buddhism and things like that, which fascinate me. So I'm excited to discuss that.
Yeah, cool.
To start out here, Clark, let me ask you, I kind of want to go back. I don't do this a lot unless it kind of has some meanings for guests, but with you, what type of kid were you and what type of like upbringing were you brought up in?
Working class. So born in Australia, Melbourne, which is the kind of the lower part of Australia, very much working class, although my father was a successful business owner. So he was in the building industry and made a lot of money from that. So I was...
I'm sorry, what was that? What did he do?
He was in the building industry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he... but he was a business owner. So he was... I grew up quite wealthy, or, you know, upper middle class, I would say. So I went to a private school. I was educated very, very well, but I was a very different man to my father. I was much more like his father. Now, his father was also working class, but his real passion was musical theatre. He had to work by day and do his passion outside of work, like a lot of people back in those days where there was less money around. So that's just what you did. I was more like my grandfather, so a creative person. My father was more like a strict business person, and you know, he liked football and beer and you know, rah rah rah, that kind of stuff. Where I was much more like my grandfather, so I gravitated towards my grandfather. As horrible as this sounds, more than my father, and my grandfather was really, in a lot of ways, the biggest influence in my life. But not him not being able to do what he really wanted to do, that had a big impact on my life. So I grew up thinking, I'm not going to follow my father. I'm not going to do what my grandfather had to do. I'm going to become a musician. And I worked really, really hard to make that happen. And in your introduction, you mentioned the VCA. So the VCA is kind of like a little bit like Juilliard, highly competitive. And I was one of the first picks in my year to get in. So there was a lot of parents and whatnot were very, very, very proud. My grandfather was obviously very, very proud of that achievement. But I remember even then that when I got in, it felt there was an emptiness about it. That was, I'd worked so hard for something, but after achieving it, it was like, really, is this it? And when I eventually got to school and seeing the teachers in the environment, I was even more disappointed, which is kind of what led me to this big epiphany in my early 20s. And that's when I moved away from that space, both that head space, I like that a psychological space, and also physical space, and moved myself out of there. It was a very traumatic event, both for me psychologically, but for my family as well. A lot of people were incredibly disappointed with the decisions that I was making about life. But so the kind of kid that I was, all of that is to say that I was a creative kid. I thought deeply even back then, thought deeply about life, the meaning of life. Why are we here? How are we here? So not just why are we here, but how are we here? Like how... what does it mean to be a human being in this world? At university, I'd have discussions about the effects of advertising on our psyche as a culture, not as only as an individual, but as a culture. So I was into that kind of stuff. But I was also very headstrong. I knew what I wanted. And this, I think this was something my grandfather instilled in me much more than my father. And that is, the ability to think for yourself is something that no one can take away from you. You can be like the Tibetans have had to go through everything they've gone through with what happened with the communists. The one thing the communists can't take away from the Tibetans is their ability to think for themselves. And I remember my grandfather saying things like that when I was a kid. So this combination of kind of headstrong, someone that knew what he wanted, or thought he knew what he wanted, went out and pursued that, but was able to think past the result. I'm not sure if that translates well into Americanism, but what I mean by that is when I got the result of achieving getting into the VCA, which is a massive result in itself, I was able to think past that because I could feel inside that something wasn't quite right. Although at the time, just being early 20s, I hadn't lived enough, as Tony Bennett said. I hadn't lived enough in order to really understand what the hell was going on. Why did I feel so? And it was subtle. It wasn't as if I was depressed. I just felt this slight emptiness.
Now that's is that something you think can be taught? Can people learn that or?
I do.
That self-awareness.
Yeah, I think self-awareness is essentially self-awareness is an ability to see pattern. It's pattern recognition. So if one is able to establish a sense of mindfulness being not the kind of the way we understand it as mindfulness meditation, which is much more than the way I'm using the word mindfulness now. Mindfulness just meaning to be able to retain a thought or an object in mind. To be mindful of something over time with the question why. Just being able to look at something critically and ask, why am I thinking this? Why am I feeling this? And then being able to sit in that moment, hovering in that feeling, whether it be an emotional feeling, like something that's coming out in your body, or a psychological thought, being able to objectively look at your stream of consciousness, as William James coined it back in the 19th century, the being able to hover in that moment as the stream of, as thoughts and emotions and memories and projections and all of that's going on and begin to tease out patterns, then you'll begin to develop this ability to introspect in an objective and mindful way, but in a critical way at the same time. And critical not as in judgmental, but critical as in critical thinking, being able to see the why behind what it is that's being presented to you. And I think that's a skill. And I think it's a skill that anyone can learn.
And I think it's great that you had that. I mean, that's something that I think should be taught at an early age, because self-awareness, I think, is so important to really look at your life as you're going through it. Like you said, it's a journey. I mean, you know, we're figuring it out as we go, and things change, your passions change, your goals change as you get older and things. And if you don't reflect and you just get in this rut and stay on one path without taking that time to self-reflect, you know, I think that's why a lot of people are unhappy. They look back at their life and it's like, what happened? They just got in this rut and weren't really paying attention to life.
Yeah. Would you like to go through life and look back at the end of it and think, you know what? I think I was half awake the whole time. That sounds horrible to me. But you know what? I think our ability to be self-reflexive, to look into ourselves, and to live that way, to think like a meditator, if you like, has utility for the business community, for the entrepreneurial community. Now, you think about it when you're coming up with a new business idea or a new product or a new project. An ability to see these patterns and really understand whether there's kind of like psychological bias in your decision making on a day-to-day basis, on a hour-by-hour basis, in the middle of a meeting. Imagine the ability to be objective about how you're feeling, about how the conversation's going when you're discussing some new business idea. And being able to see whether you're biased because you want a particular result or whether you're actually looking at the so-called data in such a way that will allow you to have good business acumen and make good business decisions as a result of that ability. I mean, it makes sense to me that this information and the whole practice of being able to think critically and recognize patterns has health benefits for one's own life. It has psychological health benefits for one's own life, but we can use that same methodology in a business environment, in a business setting, that will allow us to flourish even from our entrepreneurial our entrepreneurial journey can be fused with an ability to think like a meditator, if you like.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important, and that's why I wanted you to come on when I was, you know, looking at your story and stuff. It's like, I think what you bring to the table is so important with your background, how you've basically gone from, you know, your path has been just so interesting to me, Clark. I mean, you went in with music, with a passion, but you were always self-reflecting. So you were kind of feeling like these tugs. You were so self-aware that these little, you know, if you want to call it gut feelings, intuition, I think you're very in tune with yours. And you know when you're not on the right path. But what I love about what you've done, and I highly commend you on it, so many people get stuck because they're afraid to make a decision. And you seem to go, you know what? I have a passion for music. I'm going to pursue that. Oh, you know what? There's some things happening in my life, some different direction that I want to go to. And you're not afraid to pivot. Have you always been... I don't know if I guess secure, or have you always been one where you're not controlled by what others think or what want to say?
Totally. I don't care what other people think. I care what, there are people in my life who I respect, mentors.
Right.
And I will always go to my mentors for major decisions. But as a general rule, the way my life, the way I work is that I really don't care about what the outside world will perceive of what I'm doing. It's very much an internal thing. However, to say that, I would say it this way, I've had the courage of a stupid man. And what I mean by that is that there is a courage in the ability to pivot, but it wasn't always based on wisdom. It was just, as you said, like a gut feeling. But you honestly, like, sometimes you don't know. We certainly don't know what we don't know. It's a cliche to even say that. But cliches are cliches for a reason. They're cliches.
Right. I always say that too. Yeah, there's true. A reason for that. Yeah. They're true.
Totally, totally. And so the way that I look at it is that if I'm going to pivot, I'm going to pivot because what I'm doing now is not working. And I call these things decision points. And in the training that I've put together, there are what I call these things the cogs of our lived experience. And it's a narrative, it's a framework that's set up that really pinpoints important aspects of our lived experience and how they are, and they're like cogs, right? So they work together to create, sometimes they're what I call patterns of dysfunctionality. So you can make a decision that you think's the right thing, but because it's coming from a place of dysfunctionality, it ends up being an incorrect decision to make. So you're right. I do have this ability, and I've always seen that as a very much. I've been almost proud in a negative way of this ability, but it has also enabled. it is an enabling factor for me not finishing many projects that I've started. So it's also a problem, and it's created and therefore it's a pattern of dysfunctionality. So it's a behavioral and psychological pattern that is, through its core, dysfunctional because it doesn't work the way it's intended. So I intend to pivot in order to be successful, but the pivot in itself enables or disenables the ability to be successful because I've pivoted for the wrong reason. So it's quite complex, or it's actually quite simple when you break it down. But because it's psychological and a lot of it's emotional based, and it is more than one component stuck together to create this lived experience, it can be quite difficult to see. And just as Freud and Tony Bennett have both pointed out, that sometimes it can take decades to really work out what it is that, why have I always done this thing and it's never worked out well? And you know, eventually I come to realize what it was that I was doing. And it was at that point where I thought, you know, I'd really like to be able to, I mean, it was a few years after this, I produced 1,000 Moments Later, wrote, directed and shot and edited and did all of that between the time that I realized what I was doing to myself. And that was pretty much when my PhD is incomplete. I don't actually have a PhD. Because in some sense I failed, but when I rationalized it, I didn't fail. I just wasn't able to complete it. But between that time and finishing the PhD and finishing the movie, what I saw at the end of the PhD enabled me to complete the movie. Now I'm at a point where I know what I've done. I know what I was doing. I wonder if I can help other people realize what it is that enables them to pivot, but in such a way that creates problems for their life. I hope that doesn't sound like gobbledygook or I'm just rambling.
So what was it that you became aware of?
The best way for me to tell you this story is to tell the whole story, but it's a little bit long-winded, so I'm not sure it could literally take 15 minutes to get through it, but the setup, it's like a movie, right? In order for the payoff at the end to be an actual payoff, you have to do a setup, and the setup can be an hour. Now, I won't take an hour to get to the point, but to really understand what's going on with the payoff, you need to understand the setup. So if you're happy for me to go through that, then I'm more than happy to tell everyone about it.
Yeah. Is there a way to kind of
condense
it? I don't want to gloss over it. And I don't want to, you know, I really want the impact of it.
Yeah.
But
how about we do it this way, Brian? I will give you the cliff notes.
Okay, let's do that.
We'll start at the end. And then if you see anything in there that you want to tease out, we can do that. So
okay, sounds good.
So at the end of my PhD, I was completely burnt out. And in fact, I'll go back even higher than that. I see the cogs of our lived experience as being five things. What I call dispositional narrative, which are the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. So
yes,
these would be things like, I am an Australian, I am working class, I like philosophy, I'm very good at this, I'm not good at that. They're these stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and it's what I call dispositional narrative. They're stories, but it's dispositional. So it looks like we're actually talking about who we really are. And, you know, it's all really, when you come down to the brass tacks of it, they're just things that we've been told either through culture, through family culture, through country culture, through human culture, through our species, that we are supposed to be a certain way. Our dysfunctional narrative, through that, we tend to like certain things. And I must say that dispositional narrative, some of it's true and some of it's just plainly false. So I love philosophy and I love research. So both those things are very, very true. To say that I'm a natural academic, if I actually believe that story, would be false, because I'm not a natural academic, but I enjoy it very much. So when I'm researching, and when I was researching my PhD, the aspect that I really enjoyed was the research, was reading a book and teasing out pieces of information, taking notes, then turning to the bibliography and looking through it and going, oh, look at this book. I should read this book. I should read that book. So I'd read one book and I'd end up, because of reading that one book and getting some information that I would need for my dissertation, I'd then end up reading another three. That gave me and I call them feedback loops. So it gave me a very nice feeling. It was a positive, pleasant feeling in the body and in the mind. So I was getting feedback from both the world, external to me, and also internal. But you can see the problem with that, right? At the very start, I can now see the problem with that. It's never ending. It's like this spiral of perfectionism, because one of the other stories that I heard from my father is that my father used to say to me all the time, I'm not the smartest businessman around, Clark, but the reason why I'm successful is because I work harder than anyone else. And I heard that from when I was a little boy and I internalized it and I didn't realize.
So you got that old work hard, hard, hard in life, huh?
Yeah. The whole you got to hustle BS. I believe it's BS.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with hard work, but if you believe that you have to, and there's really the key to it. If you believe the only way to success is hard work, then you're either peddling that piece of information because you're getting something out of that, like you're selling something. The Gary V's of the world, that's his brand. His brand is hustle. Oh, yeah. So and that's not to say he's an evil person for doing that, but to say that's the key to success is BS. It's not true. And that's been proven. It's been proven by people like what's the guy's name? John Rees, who was the first guy to make $1 million in less than 24 hours on the internet. You know, over a decade ago.
Who was it?
I believe the guy's name is John Rees.
Yes, I was just going to say it was John Rees.
Yeah. So
did you ever see that interview, Clark? That him, Frank Kern and Tony Robbins did together?
I did, yes. I watched that as part of my research for the pivot that I'm now in. I looked at John Rees, I looked at Tony Robbins, I looked at Frank Kern, I looked at Todd Brown, that whole slew of internet marketers, and, you know, Russell Brunson with ClickFunnels, how to create funnels and all of that I've researched in order to be able to pivot and understand the space that I'm now finding myself in. But these feedback loops, they are dysfunctional in some ways because they're making us believe that what we're doing is the right thing because we believe, because they're pleasant feelings, you keep doing it. So right. What that does is it sets up a dysfunctional pattern. The pattern of dysfunctionality is what I call it. So for me, it meant that I just kept researching. I kept reading, taking notes. I'd read one book, and then out of that, I'd have to read a whole bunch. So fast forward several years later, and I'm now in India. I'd spent 12 months living and researching in India, living in the little village where the Dalai Lama lives. And,
oh, wow.
And I mean, it was a magnificent place. It was just, picture this. My little apartment is on the hill, on the side of a mountain. Looking out on my balcony is the Kanga Valley. And I can see on a clear day, because it's India, right? So there's a lot of dust and stuff in the air. On a clear day, particularly just after it rained, you could see, I don't know, it could be 200 kilometers. It was just this plain. It was magnificent. To the left of me are snow mountains. It's the Himalayas. And there's just this huge mountain range, and it's magical, and there's a real magic about it. It's just solid and stable and silent. The mountain is, India's not. To the right, I can see the Dalai Lama's house.
Really?
Yeah, the actual house that he lives on is on the top of a mountain, guarded by Indian police, but there's a monastery there and a temple there, and I can see all of that. And it's isolated, and that's where I did a lot of my final research. But by this stage, I'm completely burnt out. I'd spent so much time researching that I dug myself this hole of despair. And while what I was writing was good and I got some really excellent feedback, every time I'd sit down at the computer to write, I felt nausea. Now, this is at a point... in Tibetan, it's called lung. It means that you've got actual problems with your nervous system, that you've pushed yourself so hard for so long that you get pains in the chest, your hands shake, and you basically can't think. So what I found myself doing...
Wow, is it like a form of anxiety type or something?
It's not anxiety because I wasn't necessarily worried about anything. It's more, I mean, it...
Stress, like...
Yeah, I'm sure there's some kind of medical term for it. There certainly is in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and it's called lung. And you can get it from pushing in meditation. You can get it. I'm sure athletes get it. I'm sure business people get it. And I'm sure there's someone out in the audience right now thinking, that's what I've got now, or a milder form of it. So it's at that point when you are completely exhausted, but you keep pushing because you've got a deadline to meet, and you begin to get pains in the center of your chest, like a heaviness in the center of your chest, that's the very, very beginning of it. And I was at the very, very end of it. So I pushed myself through that point for several years.
Wow.
What it meant was that what I started to do was I started to make little videos of the local Tibetan communities and essentially little documentaries about them, in a way to distract myself from what I was doing, because I just felt really uncomfortable in my body and in my mind. So again, that's a pattern of dysfunction, right? So the decision that I made, and I call these decision points, had come out of this pattern, which meant the decision to stop the PhD, the decision to even research down this spiral of perfectionism, really came from this notion that I had that I had to work harder than everyone else. And I also had this feeling that I was never going to be as good as anyone else because I felt that I was not a natural academic. Now, I'm not. That's a true statement. However, that narrative that I'd set up for myself, coupled that with this thing that I'd heard from my father that I had to work harder than everyone else, meant that I worked harder than everyone else, and I worked myself into the ground because I also had this narrative of perfectionism that I was never going to be good enough. So therefore I had to keep researching because what I had was not good enough. I had to keep researching. I needed more evidence, more evidence, more evidence, and not writing, just not writing my own ideas. So in a PhD, you've got to bring something unique to the table. So my PhD was about notions of the self in Eastern philosophy and Western philosophy. I took a 14th century Tibetan philosopher and his idea of what the self is and parsed that via six Western philosophers. So the idea was great, and I got halfway through the dissertation but couldn't complete. By the time I'm in India, I made the decision that I wasn't going to be able to do that based on everything that had happened previously, but it was all patterns of dysfunctionality laid over patterns of dysfunctionality. So
how did you shift out of that then? What was the mindset to break those patterns?
So basically, I went back to Australia with my tail between my legs. I hadn't yet told anyone that I wasn't going to be able to complete. But in my heart, I knew it. Not in my head. I didn't want to give up because giving up was a negative thing. And I really wanted to get a PhD because I really wanted to marry my vocation with a way to earn money, a way to support myself in the world. Western monks and a lot of Tibetan monks can only survive through donations. And with Western monks, like, people don't give you money for nothing. So I was always looking after myself. And I kind of liked that. But I was at a point where I didn't want to do IT anymore. And that's why I went out and began the PhD. So I was now at a point.
And that's the thing. Let me just – sorry to interrupt you, Clark. Right. But I want everyone to know on here, though, you had started a career in IT and you worked your way up to, I mean, a high level, right?
You were like
one of how many in the world of what your specialty was?
Less than 60.
Less than 60. So, I mean, here's another pivot that you did that you really excelled at. And now I'm sure family members or, you know, other, you know, friends were looking at you and saying, you're going to give this up and do another thing now? I mean, so I just want people to know that you did another shift in your life that was based on staying true to yourself. And that's what I love and I think is so powerful that people need to take away listening to this, that Clark, this whole time that he's pivoting, he's going through life, he's making changes, but he's listening to his intuition, to his soul, and he's doing what he's here to do. He knows he's an educator. And even though he didn't get a PhD, with what he's doing now in his entrepreneurial life, and we'll discuss it more with your project that you're working on and everything, you are an educator. You are taking what you've learned and you are teaching it to people to help them in their lives. So I commend you. I want people to understand that you've made some big changes in there, but I just love how you stay true to yourself. So
But it doesn't always feel that way. And in fact, by the time I got back to Australia, I was homeless. I'd left the monastery to go and do the PhD, so I had no home. So I was staying at a friend's place, and by this stage, I think I'd let a few people know that I wasn't able to complete. But there was a feeling of, I wasn't humiliated, but I certainly felt down about the fact that I'd spent so much energy for the last 5 years trying to get this thing to work, and it just didn't. I wanted to marry my vocation as a monk with a way to support myself financially, and I wasn't able to complete because of my own, you know, in a lot of ways, I didn't get a lot of support from the university and the professors, but I could sit here and use that as an excuse, or I could own the fact that the real reason was that I had spiraled into this pit of perfectionality and perfectionality. Is that even a word? Of perfectionism. And that created a pattern of dysfunctionality. And really that was the reason why I wasn't able to complete. So even now, like in my mind, I'm looking at internally right now. I don't like the word fail. I didn't fail my PhD is what I hear myself say to myself. You didn't fail your PhD. You were unable to complete. The reality is I did fail, And I'm telling myself now, I'm telling myself that to myself, you did fail because you had this thing going on inside you, your psychology, where you're not good enough because you got to work harder than everyone else. And because of that, you just kept reading and reading and reading. You didn't see that pattern. You didn't recognize that pattern. And that was the cause of your failure. Now, it's all very, very subtle. And the reasons why we fail in life, I believe, is not because we're not good enough. It's because we don't understand ourselves well enough. And that takes time. So I'm in this room. I'm in this house, staying at a friend's house. I'm kind of in this pit of despair, and I don't know what to do with myself. Like, do I have to go back into IT? But now I'm five years out. How am I going to find a job? I'm getting older. Oh my God, I feel like a loser. So I rang a friend who was an older monk, a Western monk, and all my teachers were all Tibetans. So he was more like an older brother, but someone definitely a life mentor. So I rang him and told him, look, I'm not going to complete. And he said, look, I know you're probably not in the mood for a pep talk, but I think you should try and continue because what you're doing is really valuable and it's going to make a lot of people really, really happy. But I knew in my heart there was, I was not going to be able to do it. I just physically could not sit down and write. Even though I wanted to, I really desperately wanted to complete it, I knew that I couldn't. And I said to him, I feel like a loser. I feel like I'm a real loser and I'm as if I'm always going to be a loser. And then there was silence on the other end of the phone. And then he laughed. He laughed at me. And in that moment, it was, I'm getting chills remembering. In that moment, I could see what I was doing to myself and what I'd been doing to myself for decades, that I was believing the stories that I was telling myself about myself. I saw the patterns of dysfunctionality in that very moment. And in doing so, I saw there was a way out. And that's the important bit. I could see how I'd locked my hidden potential, and I could see how it was hidden because it was locked up in these stories that I was telling myself about myself. That was, you know, the feedback loops were reinforcing those stories. They were creating patterns of dysfunctionality. I was then making decisions based on those patterns, and I was continuing this cycle of failure again and again and again. Even though I at the same time I was accomplishing things, I was also failing, or at least I felt like I was failing. And, you know, it'll, again, that's me telling myself, Clark, you didn't fail. You just didn't complete. The reality is I failed. I could see a way out, and it was truly an epiphany. And, that moment changed everything. So it was a gift. That was grace. I believe that laugh from Toby was, whether he knew what he was doing or didn't know what he was doing, it doesn't matter. In Tibetan, it's called Tringle. In the Western notion, the Abrahamic version of Western spirituality, you would call it grace. It's that moment that's given to you that is a pith instruction about life. And I grasped onto it, and it changed everything. From that point, I was able to then begin again and pivot, but pivot in a very, very different way, psychologically, like mentally, physically, environmentally. Everything in my worldview changed in that moment. That's the key pivot point in my life. From then...
So was it? That like a wake-up call then for you? Would you say right there you kind of had obviously an aha moment and you were kind of able aha to look moment. Back now and see that?
Yeah, it was more than an aha moment. It was an insight into reality such that my life was never going to be the same again. Aha moments are a little more weaker than that in my opinion. They're like, oh, okay. It's an aha moment is more like starting to see these patterns in your life as opposed to a fundamental shift in who you are. So it was an unusual experience to go through, a key moment in my life. And looking back now, I can see, because I didn't know at that point. At that point, it was like, can I cuss?
Yeah, go ahead.
I thought to myself, why are you fucking laughing at me? I'm in pain here. And you're supposed to be my friend and you're laughing at me. You're like, what the fuck? That's, I mean, you know, I'm an Australian working class person. That's kind of how we think. So if I just offended a whole bunch of people, please excuse me. I'm actually a very gentle man, but we do.
No, I know that comes through. They know, but it's important to share your feelings, how you truly felt. I mean, that's the key.
The passion in that moment was that it was like, what? You're laughing at me? But at the same time, I could see what I was doing. I was like, oh my God, really? So yeah, it was absolutely a key moment. And from there, things just got better and better and better and better and better until now. I haven't gone backwards from that point. It was extraordinary.
So what was the shift then? Obviously that moment was a big moment for you. What did you do mentally? How did you start to look at things, and how did you start to change your mentality, where you were like able to start changing the stories that you were telling yourself?
So it happened slowly, and I was working it out as I was going. So now with Think Like a Meditator Master's program, I've boiled it down into key moments and the steps that I went through looking back. But when I was going through it, I was kind of working it out as I was going. The key moment was, or the initial moment was, really accepting the fact that I had failed the PhD. And you can hear in my narrative, there's a part of me that doesn't want to really accept it, that there is, so even still, I'm still, you know, really working through that. And the reason for that is that I really, really wanted a PhD, not to have the title, but because I wanted to be able to marry my vocation with a way to support myself. So, and I love philosophy.
But the funny thing is, that's what you're doing now.
Yeah. That's the irony of it. Absolutely. But it took a few years, really, to get to the point where it's like, you know, by this stage. So what happened after that was what I decided to do was, okay, so the PhD is not going to work. I have a creative background. I've been doing these little docos. I've really been enjoying creating content, visual content, and telling stories of what I called human potential around that. So whether it be a documentary or a narrative film, like A Thousand Moments Later, they all had a story to tell that was a story about the meaning of life, or a story about human potential. So the theme of A Thousand Moments Later is that love is a choice. And I took that premise and I wrapped a visual cinematic narrative around that single premise and wrote a screenplay from it. But that point enabled all of the film to get made, because in my head I went, okay, no BSing around anymore, Clark. You need to get off your ass and actually do something with your life. You're at an age now where you can no longer rely on youth, that you can rely on the narrative of, I've still got lots of life to live, and I still do, but I can't rely on that narrative. So I need to actually.
So how old are you at this time?
Early 40s. Kurt?
Okay.
So early 40s, late 30s. Sorry, late 30s. So. Yeah, so my youth's gone, right? I'm heading towards 40, and you know, by that stage, you're like you're no longer young. You mightn't be old, but you know that you're no longer young. So it's at that point where, okay, if you haven't really done too much, or you feel like you haven't done too much, you start to worry. So I still wanted to be able to marry my love of philosophy and earn a living, and what I decided I would do is to do that via art, specifically visual art. And so what I did was I went and got a job editing wedding videos. You know, I'd spent 20 years as a monk, and now here I am editing horrible videos of people getting married. It was like I would do anything in order to learn how to create a film. So I wanted to go into the film industry, and I basically deconstructed the steps to get there. Okay, so if I want to create films, I need to learn all of these skills. And I deconstructed everything that I needed to learn. And the first thing I needed to learn was to edit. Okay, so let me go and get a job where I can do that and learn, get paid to learn. So I got the lowest job that I could possibly get. I was earning less money then than I was 20 years earlier when I first started working in IT. So it was a low job. And I was happy.
I think what you just said, sorry to interrupt you, but what you just said was so powerful. And the reason I say that, Hunter Clark, is that so many people will say, and I've heard Gary Vee talk about this, and this is one point where I agree with what he says. He's kind of like a smorgasbord. You can take bits and pieces from it, you know? But what you did is you were willing to do what it took to learn to get you to where you wanted to go. And I think a lot of people say, I want to be successful. I want to start my own business. I want to do whatever it is. But they're not willing to do those sacrifices, to learn. So they're not really wanting to do it. It's more lip service than actually really wanting it. And I hope people take away from it that you just said 20 years earlier you were making more money in your life. You're at a point now where you're, you know, late 30s going on to 40s, but you're willing to do that sacrifice to change and go in a new direction. And I think that's so important that people get that message that, you know what? As long as you're still in the game, as long as you're still pursuing your dreams and you're not giving up, you can keep moving forward. Even though you may have to pivot, you may have to change, you may have to go backwards a little bit, but you can keep pursuing those. So I think what you said, I just wanted to drive that home. I think that's so important that you were able to do that.
I didn't do it for long. The money was
no, yeah. But the fact that you did it is the key.
Yeah, because it was about I had a plan. And it was about learning. It was about learning the skill. And once I got the skill, I moved on. And I moved on and I moved up. And I went from there. And then I started actually working behind the camera. I ended up shooting a couple of television commercials in Thailand. So I went from nothing through to shooting one television commercial, but some what we would call industrial videos, a lot of training videos and promotional videos that were both for in-house. So it was a large organization in Thailand. I knew these people through my days in Buddhism, so I had a step in there. But I was actually a working commercial director after a few years. And at the same time, I'm learning screenwriting and devouring all of the information in that in the film industry in order to create art. Of course, fast forward a number of years, and a similar kind of thing happened when I completed 1,000 Moments Later, as happened when I first went to the VCA, the music school back in the day, was that I'd worked so hard for this end result, and once I'd got the result, there was this emptiness again. A very similar feeling. And even though I'd had this epiphany of all these things that I was doing that was creating this cycle of failure, I was also still working my way through understanding the importance or the degree to which our dispositional narrative informs and colors our life such that we are often biased by the end result. Like, we think that if I only have this result, my life will be good. Now, I'd heard that for a long time, that happiness doesn't come from external things. It's an internal process. Yet we still find ourselves falling into that same trap again and again and again, and me included. So there's one thing to know the theory. There's another to live the practice. And really, Think Like a Meditator is about bringing those two together so that you understand the theory. You've got a practice that will integrate positive and functional narratives into your life so that you can live not only a good life, but you can live life in a good way, so that you can have the nice house, the nice car, but not believe that they are the actual source of happiness.
Can you break it down a little bit on there, Clark, as far as that program and what it covers? Like what are you teaching to help people to get to that realization?
Yeah, sure. So the basic premise of the program itself, and the premise of the theory behind it is that we all have potential. This potential is a combination of the skills, our unique skills and our unique background, coupled together with our own likes and dislikes, or likes in particular. So I have a set of skills through my IT world, everything that I've learnt over the years. And I have a love of teaching, and I have a love of philosophy. I have a love of thinking and of communicating and of talking, obviously. And so that's my potential. Now, it's locked up. That potential is locked up in the stories that I tell myself about myself, like you are working class, you have to work harder than everyone else, all of these kinds of things. And they create these patterns of dysfunctionality. But if we're able to unlock those stories, which is really about seeing the patterns of these patterns in our behavior, how they come out in our somatic experience, in our body, through to how, because the decisions we make are often the things that we tell ourselves, not only what we tell other people, you know, I've decided to do X or Y, but often decisions are made internally. If I can do this, then that will happen. That's a story in itself. So if we can unlock that whole process from our somatic experience, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and we can see these patterns and we can understand the psychological biases through our upbringing, we can unlock this potential, which is really a creative potential to, I believe it was Steve Jobs that said that creativity is just about being able to connect things. And I think he said something like, when you ask a creative person how they did something, they actually feel a little guilty because they didn't do anything at all. What happened was they saw something, they saw it, and it, after a while, it became obvious to them. Now, I think what he's talking about is it's about connecting kind of disparate ideas, an idea over here and an idea over there. If I put those two things together, then I have this other thing, and this other thing is the widget that we're going to sell. So whether it's a product or a business idea or a business, being creative is about having that ability. We all have that ability inherently, but you wrap that around your unique set of skills, and that's your potential. So if we're able to unlock that, then what will flow is just what will come out of that, what will flow out of that, the way I like to describe it, is a natural ability to flourish, to have more wealth, more health, and more happiness, more wisdom in your life, simply because you're able to deconstruct your lived experience. So the program itself does just that. It deconstructs your lived experience into these cogs, the cogs of your lived experience, the patterns of dysfunctionality, the decision points, the feedback loops, the dispositional narrative. And it does that via a set of exercises, worksheets, and the program's called Think Like a Meditator, How to Unlock Your Hidden Potential. There is a component of meditation, secularized meditation involved, but essentially this is the way I look at meditation. It's a little bit different than the way a lot of Western people present it. Meditation, and I've done it for more than 20 years. And
do you continue the practice?
Every day, hours every day. Meditation is not just about becoming more relaxed. It's not just about becoming happier and getting yourself into some kind of strange mental state where you're, blissed out. That's not meditation. The word meditation, from my perspective, what they're doing is they're translating a word, a Sanskrit word called bhavana, or a Tibetan equivalent, which is gom. Bhavana has the connotation of cultivating something, particularly something within the tradition, we would call it a virtuous state of mind, but you can think of it as a functional or constructive state of mind. And in Tibetan, the equivalent is gom, which has the connotation of familiarization with a positive, constructive, functional, or virtuous state of mind. So we're both constructing and then becoming familiar with a functional state of mind. So meditation to me is an analytic tool, it is a diagnostic tool, and it is a therapeutic tool used in the endeavor of becoming more healthy, of opening up this flow of flourishing so that life can become this wonderful thing. Now, when I say wonderful, we're still going to have bad days, but the bad days, and this arcs back to something that you said at the very, very start of our conversation, the bad days, they're reframed to no longer be bad days. Now, the feeling that you may get from your so-called bad day will still be an unpleasant feeling. You will feel unpleasant psychological feelings of unpleasantness. You know, someone screaming at you, you can't reframe that to be, ooh, la, 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 everything's like, that's ridiculous, right? You can't reframe it that way. And to reframe it that way is insanity. Someone screaming at you, that is a bad experience, but you can reframe the meaning of it so that your life becomes meaningful regardless of whether you are having a good day or a bad day. And that is the enabler to allow you to flourish. It is the enabler that will it will enable you to unlock your hidden potential to an extraordinary life.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Now, do you have an easy form of meditation that you could share with the listeners, something that they could start implementing, a way to incorporate this into their daily life?
So the cogs of experience, there's five of them, and each is related to an aspect of our lived experience. So patterns of the cycle of failure is the first one. That's related to doing, the doing of something, which is related to our somatic experience, our lived bodily experience. Each cog is related to body, speech, mind, feeling, and being, if you like. So the doing, the saying, the thinking, the feeling, and these narratives that go on in a dispositional, seemingly dispositional way. They are then related to meditations of the body, so bodily awareness, what I call focused awareness, which is awareness related to speech, awareness, open awareness, which will be everything that we think, our whole lived experience, the inner awareness, which is related to our emotions, what we're feeling, and then awareness of awareness. And I'm giving away the whole program here, Brian, which I'm more than happy to do so because it's I hope it helps someone. Awareness of awareness is awareness of being, of actually just being. So we're allowing ourselves in that point to become aware of these narratives without manipulating them, without kind of trying to control them, to push away the bad thoughts, to bring closer to ourselves the ones that we think are good. So that's kind of the framework. So if we just look at the first one, the bodily awareness, and this is where this would be the first module in the program, and this is about disengaging in what in psychology is called armoring. So imagine everyone now, imagine that someone's just about to slap your face. You there's a in your body there's this feeling of putting on armor, like you're defending yourself, right? And there's a tension right. in your body. So in order to completely change your dispositional narrative, the first thing you need to do is undo that aspect to allow the narrative to flow in such a way that you can recognize these patterns. But that's a little bit later on. The first one is essentially just disarming this physical tension that happens in the body. So, and this is essentially then just becomes classic mindfulness meditation, where you sit in a comfortable position, And you can sit in it. I mean, you can do this anywhere. You can do this at a stoplight as long as you don't close your eyes and cause traffic problems. But you could do it. You know, you could do it for 30 seconds as you're checking email, just after you check email. You can do it walking down the street, and it's essentially just becoming aware of your bodily experience. So taking your awareness. So if you think of awareness like a lighthouse, and the light of the from the lighthouse, we move that from our mental state, what we're thinking and what we're emoting, and we direct that towards our bodily experience. So the best way to start is to bring the awareness down into the point where our body is touching. So for me, I'm sitting in a chair. The back of my legs, the feet on the ground, on the floor, and to experience that contact, and then just place the awareness there and just breathe naturally. So breathing in through the nose, not forcing it, not sucking the air in and then blowing the air out. You don't need to force it at all. In fact, what we're trying to do is create like an existential relaxation, like relaxation right through to our core, almost as if we are asleep, that we're breathing. Like when we're deep asleep, in deep dreamless sleep, we're still breathing, but we have no consciousness of the breathing process. So we're breathing without in any way restricting or controlling or manipulating the breath, but we're wide awake. So becoming more and more relaxed without losing the clarity which we started the session with. And now that's the important part. I really like doing this meditation just before sleep. So it is also possible, and as I get older, I like this meditation position more and more, and that is what's called the supine position, laying down on your back, hands out, palms up, about 30 degrees out, left and right, palms up, and having your neck well supported, and then just bringing your awareness into your body, down into your abdomen, through your legs, feeling the back of, you know, the sheet of the bed on the back of my heel, and the body will then begin to relax. And as it as you deepen this practice, initially what you'll recognize is you'll start to recognize this feeling of the tension of your nervous system dissolving. And at that point, absolutely. It's a real somatic physical experience. And
now you're not focusing on your breath at all. You're just focusing on the awareness of your body, right?
So, okay. And where your body, wherever your body is making contact with some other surface. So you're placing your awareness in your body, the physical sensation of being embodied. And of course, you're also, so you're not placing your awareness on your breath, you're placing your awareness on your body, but you will feel your body as you breathe in and out, you will feel your body expand and contract. So the breathing continues, but you're not focusing on the breathing. You may be focusing on the sensation of the body making contact with the sheet as your tummy goes up and goes down, and you become aware of that, but not the breathing. So the breathing process, but not the breathing. It's a slight distinction that I'm drawing between the processes of the breath and the breath itself. So the second meditation is focusing more on the breath. And the reason for that is that your somatic experience is much more coarse. It's much more easy to bring your awareness into the body than it is to bring it to something subtle like the breath. So the breathing process is coarser. The breath itself is more subtle. But here's the funny thing, Brian. As this practice deepens, it's an amazing practice, it does have the feeling, a really nice, smooth feeling as your body becomes disarmored. You take the armor the armoring of the nervous system. As that dissolves, there is this smooth feeling that happens throughout the body. The body comes to feel very pleasant. And it's almost as if you can feel the body breathing. Now, that perhaps sounds quite existential, existential is the incorrect word. What's the word? Esoteric. It can sound a little bit like that, but it's not. It's just really just the nervous system and the body beginning, because the body's breathing for itself, the nervous system has become very, very relaxed. So that's really the first part of the first meditation. In the course, I then bring in exercises from that place to help begin to unlock an individual's hidden potential by bringing in some aspect of their personality, such that either tension or pain will begin to manifest in a particular point in the body. So for me, my right hip and my right knee, there can be, and I have no idea why, it's those particular parts in the body. But I know that if I bring up something that's happened in my past, like the failing the PhD, and still I say those words out loud, knowing that everyone else is going to hear them, and there's still pain. There's still pain around that. But that will manifest in my body in some way. So you begin to see the degree to which our body and our mind are really inextricably linked. Now, I don't mean that from a physicalist, materialist point of view, that we are only emergent properties of our brain. But a lot of philosophers no longer believe that anymore. Science really doesn't believe that anymore. The way science is presented in the media makes it sound as if the only thing that exists is the physical universe. But even you ask a scientist what is matter, they don't know. So that's not to say that matter doesn't exist, or that Descartes, that Cartesian dualism is a correct philosophical idea, because I don't believe it is. But we're much more than just a physical body. We are an embodied being that includes consciousness, our ability to perceive objects and know objects. And that's not a physical thing. That's a mental thing. So we are this complex biological entity that has these two aspects, and they are there's a togetherness about them. And this process enables you to begin to see the correlation between the two, that when I have this thought, I get this pain. But it's very, very subtle. It's not as if someone could do this, now. And, maybe there is someone that can do that right now and go, oh, yeah, he's right. It is actually something that's very subtle and that requires some practice. But the benefits of that, the benefits of being able to do that can transform a life. They've transformed my life, and I know that from a first-person point of view. So no matter what anyone ever says, I know that that's a fact, because I've lived through that experience. So, the course is just about is really about helping people discover that for themselves. It's not about indoctrinating people into a system or a way of thinking. It's about the person and myself working together to help them with their stories. And I guess that's what's unique about this system, is that it's not about adopting someone else's way of thinking or someone else's approach. The unique mechanism, if you like, to use Todd Brown kind of vernacular, the unique mechanism of this system is that we're working with your stories, your potential, your patterns of dysfunctionality, and we're using timeless wisdom to help you unlock your hidden potential, not someone else's. So that's a lot of words to answer the question that you had, which I don't even remember what the question was.
No, that was powerful. Sorry. I appreciate you sharing that, Clark. No, I appreciate you sharing that. That's powerful. And I hope everybody practices that meditation you just shared with us, because so many people, and I mean, Tim Ferriss, you're familiar with Tim Ferriss, right? Yeah. And I don't know if you read his book, Tools of Titans, or have it. I got it and gave it to a friend, so I got to get it again. But one of the biggest things he found out from all these people was that they have a a practice of meditation that they implement each and every day, sometimes morning and night, or at least once a day. But, and that's why I appreciate you sharing that, because it is so powerful, and that's something I'm definitely going to try and implement. So I appreciate that. But we're going to have links in the show notes to your program, because it sounds amazing. And what I like so much about it, Clark, is everything out there, so much of this stuff, and I'm sure you found it because you're starting to get into the internet marketing world, is everybody's showing you how to do something. And it's either it's their way, but you are showing how people can I don't know, you worded it better than I can. I'm trying to think of the words, but you're not teaching them a set practice or a certain way. It's using their stories, but it's using strategies and things that you've got from philosophy, from Buddhism, things that are ancient wisdom that people can apply to their own stories. And it's not a specific strategy. It has nothing to do with a particular religion. Anybody can do it. And I think that's what's so powerful about it. So I commend you on putting something together like that, because that's I know a lot of time and a lot of effort. That's awesome.
It was a lot of work, but it was just a lot of fun. It's when you're doing something that you love and that I think is going to be helpful to someone other than yourself, then it no longer becomes work. And I'm sure you find that with your podcast, that when you're doing something that you love and that will help others, it no longer becomes work. Of course, in order to do it and have it be long lasting, there has to be cash flow. And that's where the whole internet marketing thing comes in. You're right. It's a new world to me. I'm not frightened of marketing. I'm a little bit frightened of selling. But if you can't, if someone is not willing to pay money, you don't have a business. So you've got to be able to sell it. And through that whole process, you can then create a business that can help more people. So
now this program is available now.
It is. By the time it goes, the podcast goes live, it will be available. I'm right at the end of putting the finishing touches on everything. Okay. So yeah, and I've added some bonuses into the program itself, so that there are, if you buy the Think Like a Meditator program, you get a meditation primer. So my meditation 101 course, you get as a bonus, as well as 12 months of my inner circle membership program, which has like a weekly kind of roundup question and answer kind of. I'm thinking about calling it, and maybe I can put this to your listeners. I was thinking about calling this weekly. It's not a chat show. It's just me on a couch. So I've called it on the couch with Clark. I told my wife about it, and she laughed at me.
On the couch with Clark.
That's what I thought. And it would just be me kind of answering questions that had come in from the week earlier. All of that is to say that if someone comes in, has never done any kind of meditation at all, there's a primer to get you up to speed on what some of the terms are. So you begin to understand the parlance of meditation, as well as some guided meditations. Then there's the course itself that you go through. And then there's a follow-up where you can, for 12 months, you can come back in and ask questions, and I will answer it. I've also set up some coaching. So if you want one-on-one coaching, or for it to be a little bit more hands-on, where the two of us together are working through unlocking your hidden potential, there's also that there, and that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, and we'll have that linked in the show notes.
Thank
so everybody
you,
can
Thank
go
you.
Check that out. Because, oh no, absolutely, I think it's awesome what you're doing. Like I said, I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a great program, and I think you're going to help a lot of people with your wisdom and stuff you need to share. Now, I want to be respectful of your time, Clark. I got so much here that I still would love to ask you. I might have to have you back on the show so we could delve into some other stuff, but I want to ask you a few more questions before we wrap up here, if you don't mind.
No problems at all.
All right. Going back let's go back to when you were in the monastery. You were there for about, 15 years or so, living with the monks and so forth. What would you say, give me one or two of the biggest lessons that you learned from there that has helped you to where you're at now today?
One or two of the biggest lessons. I would say that I've become, and this may be, this may sound surprising and a little benign, but it's had a major impact on my life. So the biggest thing that's really changed for me is that I'm far less judgmental. Now, I was never a judgmental person, but and what I mean by that is that when something or someone does something either to another person or to myself, the narrative of what a horrible thing this is or what a horrible person that is, that person is, that's dissolved into a more global understanding of human nature and the human condition, and that we are all really a combination of everything that we've experienced. So if someone has had bad experiences and a lack of education, then their behavior is likely to be destructive and selfish and whatnot. If they've, that same person had the same experiences, so like a bad upbringing or they'd been abused or, you know, they're perhaps suffering from complex PTSD, something like that, that same person with education can be fixed. So for me, that would be the biggest one, is just this far more gentle, compassionate, empathetic approach to life. And when I mean, you know, it's funny, Brian, that the when I come from quite a robust house, my father and certainly my grandfather, he was a massive influence in my life and a very gentle and kind man, but an Australian kindness. Australian kindness is very similar to Tibetan kindness. Tibetans and Australians can be very robust, very straightforward, very frank. And if you've done something wrong, there's no, like, you just get told that's wrong. There's no,
it's not sugarcoated,
not
huh?
at all. So we tend to be, we can tend to be very, very direct and unapologetic about being very, very direct. But if it comes from a place of compassion and a place of empathy, then it's done with love, but without all the sugar coating, as you said, without all the sugar coating of it appearing as if it is empathetic. So I would say that's probably the biggest thing that I learned that was just really, yeah, compassion and empathy. I'm verbose, Brian. I'm sorry, mate. I talk a lot.
No, I love it. You're like me. I can go on and on about subjects. So no, I think that's so important what you just said there, because that's one of the things that, and it's one thing that was a fault of mine growing up. I grew up more like my mother, more of a people pleaser, where my dad was kind of like you said, where, you know, he could let things roll off him. He could take direct stuff. And so it's been something I've had to learn with when people are direct and stuff, to understand that, hey, it's, you know, especially when you know who it's coming from, that it's coming from more of a loving, respectful thing, not as a hurtful thing that someone's saying. So it's something that I have to work on and learn. So I think you growing up with that, with the Tibetan and the Australian background, I think that's a positive thing to have that most people have, because I think a lot of people worry too much what others think and it holds them back. So I think that upbringing was something that was powerful. And for you, what you've gone through, your journey and the way you were able to pivot, like you said earlier to me, you don't care what other people think. Now, not to be like you don't care about what others, but you don't let that affect you negatively. And you pursue what you're doing because it's what you want to do and it's what you believe.
People are going to think what people are going to think. And there's nothing that I can do about that. So all I can do.
My dad always says, what other people think of me is none of my business.
And that it can sound cold, as if you don't care about that person. And it's not that. It's not allowing other people's narratives to influence your own. So I would say you asked for two. That would be the second. The second would be, because that's not something, while I had it as a young man, as a potential, allowing that to really kind of manifest into my world and understand that it's not a pig-headedness. It's actually it's a virtue. It's a good way of engaging in the world, not allowing yourself to be the victim of other people's bad behavior on the more coarse level, and on the more subtle level, not allowing yourself to be influenced by other people's narratives. So there's, you know, your world at the moment, in your political system at the moment, is being kind of, I mean, it's falling apart from the inside. And there are a lot of people just placing the blame on the other side, and both sides are doing it. So to me, if we take that into an individual and take it out of the realm of politics, which is murky and not always useful, and bring it back into one's own psychology, if we can, in a similar way, not be influenced by the rocks that are thrown towards us, then we can have a better understanding of what it is that we actually need to do in the moment. And then that can come out we can engage our life from that point of view. Then we can be more true to ourselves without having to kind of force ourselves to be more true in ourselves. It's just a natural way of living. Our lived experience transforms into one of authenticity, to use a horrible cliche. That word's been used so much, but it's true. Being true to yourself is a practice that eventually you end up living in an authentic way, and then life becomes truly like an amazing adventure, and everything that happens, you feel, whether it's true or not, you know, there's the old platitude that everything happens for a reason. I don't know whether that's right or wrong, and for this discussion, I really don't care, but we can live our life as if that is true, that everything that happens to us it's not happening to us, it's happening for us, if you like.
Yes. Yep. Big distinction there. Definitely. So what are you doing now currently, Clark, that scares you and is making you stretch?
Life.
Do you have a project or something?
Tony Bennett is totally correct when he says that life will teach you to live as long as you can live long enough. I love that saying. I love the way it just rolls off the tongue. I love that it has kind of levels of meaning, and it stops you in your tracks and makes you think and kind of deconstruct the actual language pattern. I love it, and it's just so true. So on a daily basis, I wake up, you know, thankful that I'm still here and that I've got this opportunity to live, just to live. And I wake up and life stretches me, because I think it's with every waking moment is an opportunity to learn about yourself, about the world. Every waking moment informs our lived experience, so it can be used as fodder, as information, as wisdom to enable us to become better human beings, to evolve from a consciousness point of view, to evolve our consciousness, to become more awake, to use Buddhist parlance, to become enlightened. But I don't want to go down that whole rabbit hole. If we think of it more as a way of becoming more self-reflective, and that cognitive ability of being able to turn our consciousness in the light of our awareness back in on itself, so that we become more aware of who we are internally, that our external life just becomes better and better and better. And then we don't have to, I don't know why this flashed into my mind just then, but we don't have to do marketing via these horrible, when I first started looking at marketing, I won't name names, but I came across a couple of marketers that had pictures of themselves in front of expensive cars with young ladies in bikinis and big mansions. Yeah. And when I saw that, my heart, I didn't judge this gentleman. It was more, oh man, you're missing out. You're kind of misunderstanding. Now, maybe it's just all branding, and but it's branding in such a way that it's not, in my opinion, it's not helping those that hear that person's message. It's actually making those people more, it's like drinking salt water. You may be thirsty, so you drink this this whatever this dude is selling, but it in fact makes you more thirsty. So and that's all that's all about or comes from this place that believes that happiness comes from something external to ourselves, and it just does not. Happiness can be generated via an external object, but the happiness is an internal process. So it's our relationship to that external thing that is causing the happiness, not the thing in and of itself. I love Porsche cars. My father, as a young guy growing up, my father had a Porsche. So I've got this weird thing, and it's a theory of mine that the first 4 years of our life are so impactful to who we are as adults. I can hear a car go past and I can know whether it's a Porsche or not just by the sound of it. Now, my father had a Porsche car, when I was a very young man, and still I know the sound of a Porsche. So I have an attachment to Porsche cars. I don't own one. I'm not likely to own one. But I know that if I was to walk into a Porsche dealership and lay down a wad of cash and say, I'll have that one, that there would be happiness and pleasant feelings that would arise from that. But would that make my life, would that make me happy? No, it wouldn't, because in...
Right. And how long would those feelings last?
Exactly. The happiness is not an external, it's not coming from the thing itself. But the thing itself can be a catalyst for it, for happiness. So if we can see that distinction, then we can begin to live life in such a way as that you can have the Porsche and, you know, you can have the cake and eat it too. You can have the Porsche and the happiness and it won't dissipate, because you know you're coming and engaging life from a place that understands from an embodied point of view. You understand that your happiness is contingent on your mental state. And if you understand that well enough, you can have the Porsche and the happiness at the same time. So that's really, I don't think I'll ever own a Porsche, but that's kind of what I'm working towards, because in the Buddhist tradition, culturally, and certainly the way it's kind of grown up in the West, there's this, and it's very, very true within other religious sections of the population, that money equals evil. Money equals there's something wrong with you. And that's, how can that be true? It's just not true. But I've had to work through that psychology, that it's somehow virtuous to be poor. Even when I was earning a lot of money back in the IT days, there was a feeling of guilt. Like, should I really be earning all of this? Of course, what I was doing is I'd work on projects for 3 months and then go off for 6 months and just spend all that money living, but, you know, doing what I actually wanted to do, and that was to be a monk. And then I'd have to go back to work again, and I was on, off, which was the reason why I ended up trying to do the PhD, because I wanted to be able to go to work and do the thing that I loved, as opposed to go to work for 3 months and hate it and then spend time doing what I loved. I didn't want to be my grandfather that hated what he was doing during the day, and you know, would wake up and think, oh my God, I got to go to work again. This sucks. But enjoy the weekends and enjoy his time outside of work. I wanted to marry the two. So,
yes.
Yeah.
That's the key. That's what everybody's goal should be.
I think that's what
be.
We should all be striving towards, is allowing ourselves to live the good life, and understand what that actually means. And perhaps that way you can have everything that you want and not turn into a completely neurotic, guilt-ridden person.
Yep, and I think that's what your program is going to teach people. So that's why I think it's so powerful. Two last questions for you here, Clark. I know you were big into reading, and you did a lot of research. I love reading myself. What 1, 2, 3 impactful books that had a big influence on your life or made a big change that you would recommend to my listeners?
Wow. Okay. So any books at all?
Yeah, anything. I mean, whether it's on philosophy, it's on Buddhism, just something that you think would be that it helped you some way in your life that you think would be impactful to share and others should read.
It's actually a really tough question. A lot of the books that I've read are so philosophically dense that I'm not likely to recommend them.
Well, I got one of yours that you had, which was the Tibetan
Book of Living and Dying.
What was it? Yes, I went and bought that after I listened to your 20 years and 20 day video challenge you did. So I started reading that. So I figured, hey, if it's good for Clark, it's going to be good for me. So I started it. So I appreciate that one. So I'll put that in the show notes. But anything else?
I was going to mention that book, but I didn't want to be parochial about my background. That was a major book in my life. It was really the catalyst for that first real pivot from this life that had been laid out for me, and that was, you know, if I followed that path, I was going to be a professional, a musician, and probably quite good at it. But there was this emptiness that just was eating me from the inside. I either had that choice or I follow this, and it was just an intuition, this thing over there. And I've said somewhere, I think in a PowerPoint presentation that I'm doing for a sales video, that it was, looking back now, that book was almost a metaphor for that point in my life, that I was between two worlds, life and death, literally life and death, and east and west. So if I stay in the west, I'm dead. And if I go towards the west, I felt, and it was really just a scent, like an intuition that if I pivot in this direction, things are going to get better. And of course, it took 20 years before that all happened. And because, yeah, life is a journey, and I wouldn't change anything that I did. I'd probably, if I had to change anything, I'd probably be more compassionate towards my parents in the way that I spoke to them about what I was doing. I think initially I was quite dismissive. This is my life. You've got no say in what I do. Now, as an older person, and seeing the impact that our words can have on others, even people who are older than us, I'd be more gentle and more kind in my approach to them. But you know, when you're in your early 20s, it's, you think you know everything, and you think you've got almost you feel entitled to say whatever comes into your mind, you'll just say it. And not that I was a nasty person, because I'm not, nor did I say anything nasty. But I wasn't as gentle, and I didn't approach it with a gentleness that I wish that I had of, because I caused, particularly my mother, undue stress just because I was pivoting so hard, you know, because it literally was, you know, one tradition to another. It was, and that was so proud. You know.
Yeah, it was major.
Yeah,
major
stuff. Yeah, it was. There are a couple of other books. So the Dalai Lama has a book called The Art of Happiness. There is another one that he wrote wrote together with a Western person that is about science. I think it's – I'm vaguing on the title of it. I read that in about 4 hours. It's, you know, a couple of hundred pages. You could literally read that in a day. It's an easy read. But if there are people who are interested in the Buddhist worldview and how that model, because it's really just a model, how that model can fit onto or overlay science, or the other way. For me, it was like I've got a very strong interest in science, and I wanted to see how that model fit over the Tibetan tradition. So for me, that was it was one of those books that was just like a page turner, and I really enjoyed.
Do you know roughly what the title is,
Clark? How about I send you an email and you can put it in the show notes? I'll find
the title. Link it up there, because I want to check.
Yeah, that was a great book, and it's a little bit. It's not like reading the prose itself. The words and the structure of the word is partially not academic, but it's kind of leaning towards more of an academic style of prose, of the actual sentence structures, which I enjoy reading that style of writing. So those two books, they would be good starters, I believe.
Perfect. So. Good. Last question for you, Clark. What is the impact you want to have on the world?
I'd like to leave the place to quote Tyrion Lannister from Game of Thrones. So that's the little guy, the hand of the Dragon Queen. I am not by any means a Game of Thrones enthusiast. I have watched a couple of episodes, and I have no idea why his name just popped into my head. But he said he talks about wanting to leave the place a better world. And as cliched as that is, I think that that's true. I think that if I can live my life such that whoever I come into contact is better for that experience than not, then I've lived my life well. That's the external thing. The internal thing is that everything that I do, and I say this to my wife, you know, I was a Buddhist monk, and I was a Buddhist monk for a long time. That didn't mean that I was not interested in girls. I just had to manage my mind during that time. I'm now married, and I've said to her that everything in my life, because I must say that even though, and here's the reason why I brought that up, you can take the monk out of the monastery, but you can't take them, or you can take the man out of the monastery, but you can't take the monastery out of the man. So there's a part of me that's still very much interested in contemplative practice. I still meditate every day. I still read every day. A lot of what we read is, and we read it together. And here's another book. I didn't read it, but Sophie did. Is a book by the title is Grit and Grace by a gentleman by the name of Ken Wilber. Now Ken, he's an old Buddhist Dharma practitioner, and he's now gone off and done his own kind of thing. And I know nothing about what he's done with his own thing, and I know really nothing about his story, but I know that this book is about their relationship. She died of cancer, and their relationship was quite traumatic, obviously, because of what they went through with her dying, eventually dying. But it is such an honest account of a relationship that has its problems and how they worked through it that it's just an extraordinary read. So every now and you know, we'd be lying in bed reading, and she would say, "Have a listen to this," and she'd just read a paragraph or a page or three pages, and you'd be shocked at some of the honesty. It was amazing. The thing that I think is important for couples to understand is that your arguments, your battles, your way, your power struggles, your feelings of being abandoned, of not being good enough. Everyone else in the world that's in a relationship has some version of that story, and that by understanding that, we can be more gentle, firstly to ourselves, because compassion and love must begin. You cannot have a compassionate person who is not compassionate towards themselves. If you don't have self-compassion, you cannot have compassion for others. So by understanding that, we can begin to have compassion for ourselves. We can see ourselves as being not perfect. And in that not perfectness, there's a perfection, if you like. There's a, because it enables vulnerability. And as we all know via someone like Brené Brown, vulnerability is the cure to feelings of shame. And feelings of shame are essentially what bind us into patterns of dysfunctionality. If we're shameful of who we are or what we've done or what we think, or how we think about ourselves, we will never get out of our, we'll never be in a position where we will even begin to read how vulnerability is the cure to shame, because we won't even want to go there. So this book really shows in an incredible amount of honest detail just how dysfunctional these people were. And, you know, I think the courage in that is there's far more courage in that than any courage that I've ever shown in anything that I've ever done. So I would say that that's wow. that probably be that would be my third book.
Okay, perfect. Wow, we'll definitely put that in the show notes, and I'll look into that myself and get some details. So how can we get in touch with you, Clark, if the listeners want to follow up? I know you got your website, plus you have Clark Scott Education.
So the best place would be clarkscotteducation.com. That's Clark with an E.
Okay.
And the link will be in the show notes, I assume. I hope that's okay, Brian.
Oh, yeah. No, it'll be in there, definitely.
And so...
Any social medias to reach out to you?
Social media is a funny phenomenon. I do have a Twitter account, but it has not been updated in so long. I have Instagram, same. Facebook is kind of where I'm building out the community. So because I think, you know, social media is supposed to be this social thing, but really the people who benefit most from social media are the companies who produce these platforms. Yeah. They're the one they make, because really it's essentially it's a business, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not in any way suggesting there's something inherently evil with that. However, if we are to use these platforms as means of communication, then for me the best one at this point is Facebook, because it allows me to do something like On the Couch with Clark, where someone can log on to Facebook, and if they can go on to the page and see, you know, the first, I don't know how long it's going to be, it might be 10, 15, 20 minutes of a Facebook Live of one of an episode of on the Couch with Clark. And I can allow people who are not behind the paywall of the membership site to get access to, you know, okay, so what's this all like? What does he look like? I've heard his voice, but do I actually resonate with this guy? And they can watch some of it, and then I can just hit stop on the Facebook Live, but keep recording the version that my paid members will eventually see. It enables, it's a platform that enables true social media. The media is social. And
so do you want me to put that in the show notes then too, to let people to get a flavor of Clark and kind of see what you're about?
The links are on the website as well. I'm doubling down on that. And of course, this is a business podcast, and we know Facebook ads are crushing it at the moment. So I'm really doubling down on Facebook advertising and really, first of all, understanding how that all works. There's a lot of information out there. So I've done a couple of courses on Facebook advertising and how to do all of that. So I'm kind of still in a learning phase. But I would say that if you end up going, so this is now to you, the listener, if you end up going to the website, you'll probably get retargeted. So I feel like I'm supposed to apologize for that. But that's kind of how it works.
No.
That's the beauty of Facebook is that it, from an advertiser's point of view, it allows us to do that, but not in a pushy, here's my new ad. Not in a interruptive kind of way, like television. It's just sitting there in the feed. Right. And if it's educational based, I'm just reminding someone, hey, let me help you. You know, here's...
Yep, Jay Abraham. You've heard of Jay Abraham?
I have heard the name. Is that the guy that did the persuasion thing?
He's the one that he's worked with so many cross businesses. Look him up for marketing. I love his stuff. It's great. He's got a lot of wisdom. He's been in tons of different industries, and he's kind of like the go-to guy for like direct response. But it's in a good way. It's not the cars and mansions. It's educational based, and he's just got so many good stuff. I'll share with you in an email. I think I'll put it in the show notes too, but he has a website where he just has tons of stuff for free. He doesn't even sell it, and it's just so much good information. But he says, if you have something of value to give to the world, a service, a product or something, it's your obligation to get that to them. You're doing a disservice by holding that back from them. So if you're truly helping people, then you got to get that message out. So it's a great platform for that. So no, don't feel guilty about it. You're doing something good. You're not pushing soda on people or something.
Yeah, you know exactly. I mean? And it, actually, what you just said then reminded me of the fact that the way I've set up the website, there's free training on the website. So if you go to the website and there's a page that says start here, and of course, you know, it's marketing, right? So you've got to give me your first name and email. But through that, there's a whole bunch of free training that basically goes through the Think Like a Meditator master's program in an educational way. Now, it is a sales video. So in a similar way to what Frank Kern does, where he says the best way to sell is just to teach people, is to help people first. So I'm hearing that Jay Abraham is probably an older guy than Frank, maybe even Frank's mentor.
Oh, yeah. No, he's older than Frank. Frank's probably
learned from Jay. It sounds that way, yeah, because it sounds like that's what Frank does. And so I've learned from the younger generation, the Frank Kern, the Todd Browns of the world, and it's very much about education and just give. You give. It's, you know, was it Gary Vee that said give, sell? Well, no, his was jab,
yeah,
right hook or something, yep, like punch. That.
Yeah, jab, right hook, yeah, I think.
What
I
he meant
book,
by
yes.
that was teach, and then try and teach some more, but in order to teach more, that happens behind the paywall. And that's the model that I'm approaching. And that way people can get something for free. It can help them. If they want to go deeper on it, then they have to pony up some coin, and then, you know, I'm there in this on their side, working together with them to help them become even better. And to me, that really, it just sits well, because you're not selling anything; you're just helping people.
Exactly. And my audiences are marketers. They're online marketers and entrepreneurs. So they're going to understand and appreciate it, because that's what they're doing as well. So it's all good stuff. All right, Clark. Well, I took up more time than I told you I would of yours, but I just want to thank you for coming on the show. This has been awesome.
I've enjoyed it.
I mean, I could probably talk to you for more hours, bud. There's so much stuff that we could cover. And like I said, I might have to have you back on the show if you're willing to come on, and maybe we can delve into some more philosophy and maybe a little bit more of the Buddhism, the mentality behind it and stuff like that. But I appreciate your time. I know it's kind of weird because I'm talking to you in the future. You're a day ahead of me now. Yeah. So this is kind of awkward, but it's cool how we're able to do that stuff and connect with you. So I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for sharing what you shared. Your journey is amazing. And everybody listening, please go to the website, look into Clark. He's got some videos on YouTube. He's got the 20 years and 20 days where he's done some videos. There's some great stuff in there. He tells more of his story. Just check him out. Follow him. He's a good guy. He's here to help, and he's got a lot of wisdom and a lot of experience. I think you guys are going to gain a lot out of it. He's somebody that I'm going to start following more into. I was excited to research you. I learned a lot, and I want to stay connected with you. I appreciate you. Perfect. All right, everybody, thanks again for listening to another episode. Take notes. Go back and listen to this. There's so much that was shared. And until next time, guys, I wish you a brilliant life.